From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. I'm Catherine Lynch, and this is the first monthly podcast from Bletchley Park. In it, I'll bring you stories from the Codebreakers themselves, fascinating facts and artifacts which are still emerging, and reports on the development of Bletchley Park. Coming up, we'll hear from children enjoying a family fun Wednesday with a spy school and a top secret workshop, which run every week throughout the school holidays. And we'll hear from Captain Jerry Roberts, a senior cryptographer and linguist who worked in the testery breaking Tunny. I'll bring you an extract of his talk on Alan Turing at the sellout Turing Education Day. But first, let's hear from the Chief Executive of the Bletchley Park Trust, Ian Standen, telling me how he plans to spend £7.4 million restoring derelict code-breaking huts and the home of the card index, Block C. You can hear from the echoey nature of our voices, but can you try and describe the state of this building we're in?
We're in C Block here, which was the card index during the Second World War. It was used after the war and has been empty for, must be 25 years or more now. And this is going to be our new visitor centre reception for the site of Bletchley Park. And as you can see from the state of the building, it's looking a bit tired. The walls are peeling, the roof's falling in, and the floor underneath our feet is pretty damp and squelchy. So quite a challenge to restore this building.
A happy home to quite a number of pigeons at the moment, though, isn't it?
Indeed, yes. You make careful you don't get dive-bombed while you're working in here. But having been derelict, as I said, you can see it's falling into a really horrid state of repair, and therefore the challenge for us as we move forward is to take this back to the 1940s feel, get rid of all the internal walls that were put here post-war, take it back to the big open-plan building it was during the Second World War.
In itself, that's quite a daunting to-do list, but it's only one element of the funding package and the plans for it. Can you tell us what else will be done?
On site, as well as turning this building into a visitor centre, of course, we're going to take the iconic 1939 wooden huts, the ones that were built as soon as the government code decipher school occupied the site for the early code-breaking efforts. I'm going to take them back to their 1930s, 40s feel and restore them as sympathetically as we can to put them back into use. And the third element is to take the centre of the park and start to turn the landscape again back to the 1940s feel, trying to take away some of the extraneous 21st century paraphernalia, the yellow lines on the road, some of the car parking, some of the lights and those sort of things, and try and get that 1940s wartime feel.
So you want to recreate a feeling of what it would have been like to walk around and thinking about the problems that faced them, and that they did have built in, didn't they, space and time to go and think in quiet places.
Absolutely. The management here was quite enlightened and saw the need to keep some open space so that the co-breakers, when they had breaks, lunchtimes and meal times, could go out into some grounds and relax and get away from the pressure, the relentless pressure of working to try and break the German codes.
It must have been hard, and I know some of this predates you being at Bletchley Park, but it must have been difficult to choose which buildings came first, because £7.5 million sounds like a lot of money, but it's only the beginning of actually restoring the real estate we have here.
As I understand it, and it makes sense to me, really the logic was, first of all, that the huts were in the worst state of repair, and indeed they're in danger of falling down, so they need to be stabilised straight away. And they're at the centre of the park, so it was the easiest place to start with, and start pushing out to the perimeter. C Block, where we're standing, is the obvious place of visitor centre. It's right next to our entrance, and again, so it just made obvious common sense to turn that into the visitor centre and get it underway as soon as we can, because it then means when people arrive on the site, they can immediately get an orientation experience. The new displays we're going to have here will give them the story, give them a feel of what the site's all about, and allow them to go and explore the rest of the site with that knowledge in their heads.
And that's quite apt, given that it contained the card index where you would cross-reference.
Absolutely, that's quite a nice linkage there, absolutely. You've got that sort of centre of knowledge, which now will be a centre of knowledge as we move forward.
And, of course, where we've restored Hut 8 and Hut 4, they're, you know, part of the visitor experience. You know, 6 and 3, what we're going to do there will be much more authentic.
Absolutely, that's definitely the aim, is to take them back as sympathetic as we can. So, you know, plank in, plank out. If the plank is not fit for purpose, it can be replaced. But if it is fit for purpose, it goes back into the hut. Of course, the limitations, because they're listed buildings, is only so much we can do in terms of the internals of the buildings, and therefore the rooms will remain as they are, and therefore it makes it difficult from a museum point of view to get people through them. So they'll be interpreted by what we call light touch interpretation, which means that people will move through quite swiftly, walking past an office, looking in, see it perhaps dressed, walking past another one, well, there'll just be a bit of audio, a bit of visual, perhaps even some smell to get the understanding of what it was like to be in the offices. Fairly swift flow through the buildings, which means we can get more people through them to get that experience of what it was like to work and live in a co-breaking hut.
And you must be visualising what it will be like when it's all done. What's the one thing that sticks out for you that you will think, yes, we're there, we've done it?
Difficult one. I think for me, I suppose, it's getting rid of all the modern junk of the site. You know, not seeing cars parked outside the mansion, and perhaps to hear visitors to say what a peaceful place this is.
Every Wednesday throughout the summer holidays, we have activities just for children. The first Family Fun Wednesday was on the hottest day of the year so far. Children took lessons at Spy School, took part in World War II workshops, and heard what it was like to be an evacuee. And the day was rounded off with a spectacular flypast by a Spitfire.
Just starting this lady off, and she's done brilliantly. She's got all of that done with very little help at all. And it's quite tricky, the first one with the little ones, because, you know, they've got sticky hands, it's hot, and trying to manage the wool and the needles is quite difficult, but this young lady is managing very well. And that's your daughter, isn't it?
Yes.
So my hope is that mother will be able to help daughter soon. My job will be redundant.
What's your name?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, how are you getting on?
Well, I'm struggling a bit, but it's just fun.
Is it your first go at knitting?
Yes.
Did you think when you came to Bletchley Park to learn about code breaking you'd find yourself knitting?
No.
What have you got in progress there? Is that going to be a scarf or a patch
I'm trying to make like a little square patch for the start. Just to start
on a blanket or something.
Yeah, maybe, but something just small.
Is it difficult? It looks a bit tricky.
Yes, very fiddly.
Oh, I'll leave you to it. Thank you.
This is good looking.
Power troopers or glider balloons. This was Ox and Bucks. They were first in on D-Day at Pegasus Bridge. They landed at 16 minutes past midnight at minute intervals, and they captured the bridges in 10 minutes.
Is this a proper gun?
No, it's a replica. In wartime, when we didn't have enough guns, the Home Guard used broomsticks.
Yeah.
So obviously, the chap said, well, I want something that looks like, so he made himself a replica of a rifle.
I was 6 when the war started, my brother was 4, and we had a baby just weeks old. And I remember the man came to the house and he measured us round our forehead for our gas mask. We had the Mickey Mouse gas mask. And then because we had a garden, we had then had the Anderson shelter. So that was full of spiders and insects and everything like that. Always, always very damp. But once the Blitz started, then that was a different story altogether. If you say to me, well, what do you remember of the bombing? I can remember being down to the shelter, and I can remember the noise of the bombs, the whistling and the smell, and also how that little old shelter shook. But your mum and dad were there, so that didn't really matter. It was then the government said, get the children out. And I remember the morning of the evacuation was just like any other morning. There wasn't anything to say what was going to happen. And I remember we got up and we had our breakfast, and I started to put on my coat. My mother looked at me. She said, don't put that coat on, put your best coat on. And I said, it's not Sunday. She said, just do as you're told. So off went my school coat on, wear my best coat. I put on my gas mask. Then Mum came over to us and she started to tie a label onto the gas mask. Something was going on. We went out of the house and there's all our school friends, exactly the same. Off we went down the road. We got onto the coaches. Coaches pulled away. There was no laughter, there was no chatter, because we just didn't know what was happening. We went along to a mainline station. There were thousands and thousands of children there being looked after by the Red Cross and the WVS. From that moment on there, parents weren't allowed to walk with us. They left us there. They weren't allowed to hold our hand or be with us. I held my brother's hand. My parents were walking behind, and we kept being chivvied along by the Red Cross. And we went onto the platform. And in the platform, there was a huge, great train. And as I went onto the platform, I heard a crash. And when I turned around to look, they pulled the barrier across. So we're one side of the barrier, and my parents are the other. So we had no kisses, no hugs, no goodbyes. We were just literally taken away. And that was the last I remember, being put into the carriage, the door slammed, and the train pulled away. And at the age of 6 and a half, I thought my mum had carried out her threat. We'd been naughty and sent us away. And I thought, it doesn't matter, I'm going back tomorrow. But it was going to be 6 and a half years before we ever went home again.
So we brought 4 children to Bletchley today, and they've had a good fun day. They've been spies and learning about being spies, and now they're just meeting the pigeons. No, Emma didn't want to do the spies, so she went to the toy museum instead, and we liked that, saw all the toys. It was a bit scary that some of the toys Mummy and Mummy's sister had, when we were young, made us feel a bit old. So there's a really good playground as well, and the children all had fun in there for half an hour, just next to the cafe where they could get a nice cold drink. And there was enough even for my little one, who's only 21 months to do, so she had a bit of a run around. But probably most of the activities are aimed at the older children. But you've had a good day, haven't you? We've got lots more to do. We're going to go to the dancing next, aren't we? But lovely big open setting, easy parking, works well for everybody.
Next on the Bletchley Park events calendar is the Enigma reunion on Sunday the 2nd of September, which coincides with the Armed Forces weekend, when we look at how the co-breakers of Bletchley Park assisted the armed forces during World War II. It will celebrate the role of the armed forces throughout history, and in particular the role of the cadet forces, with a field gun run by the Navy cadets. Captain Jerry Roberts is possibly the only person left alive who intercepted messages from Hitler himself. He gave the annual Turing lecture at the sellout Turing Education Day on June the 30th. He was introduced by one of the other eminent speakers lined up that day, Lord Charles Brockett.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are very lucky to have Jerry Roberts here with us. He worked in a special section that was set up under the leadership of Captain Ralph Tester, and it was known as the testery. At its height, remember that Bletchley had 10,000 people working here. At its height, the testery had 9. Jerry Roberts, a young 20-year-old at the time, was one of those 9 people. Now, that tells you, if only 9 in that section, they probably were quite different people and quite gifted people, as Jerry not only was, but still is. Now, these extraordinary individuals worked round the clock to access the inner secrets of the German High Command with what has been described as the outstanding mental feat of the 20th century, because all of this work was not done with a computer. It was done with a pencil and some paper. And Jerry is, I think, the only person now left alive in the world who intercepted Hitler's messages direct from him. Before I hand over to Jerry, his last remark was, when I talked to him and I wrote an article about him, was he proud of the part that he played? And he said, not really. The real heroes, who were quite exceptional, were Alan Turing, Tommy Flowers, and Bill Tutt. Jerry, over to you.
Charles, well done as ever. That's going to take a bit of living up to. The first time I came to Bletchley Park was in 1941, autumn. And at that time, We were not allowed even to come into the house at the beginning. It was off limits. And it's splendid to see it peopled so well now, but it was very different then. I was asked to talk about Tunney and the breaking of Tunney, but I would like to spend just 5 minutes talking about Turing, because quite honestly, from one point of view, if it hadn't been for Turing, we wouldn't be sitting here. I'm personally, eternally grateful to him that I didn't have to bring up my children under a Nazi regime. The reason for that is in the tonnages. The average for the 4 months, March to July 1941, was 282,000 tons of shipping lost. 282,000. Turing broke Naval Enigma in July, August 41. By November, those tonnages had dropped to 64,000, a drop of 77%. If he hadn't managed that, it is almost certain that Britain would have been starved out of the war and defeated, and we would have entered a dark age, a Nazi dark age of what, 30 years, 50 years? Once the Nazis had got you down, they didn't let you up. And I had glimpses of this when I met the friend of a neighbour a few months ago. He had been in the SAS during the war, a tough unit, and he made a crossing of the Atlantic in early 41, and he told me about it. When he did, his face darkened. "The worst days of my life," he said. "We left port with 23 ships, and we arrived in Britain with 11. U-boats had downed 12 ships with all their, and left the crews struggling in the water or on lifeboats. And I had a further taste of it after the war, because after the war I met a wonderful, brave Belgian lady called Madame Gentil, and she had been one of those families who kept a safe house for Allied airmen shot down over Europe and trying to make their way back to Britain to fly again. And Helene Gentil and her husband had a hidey hole in their house, and they had an airman in there one day when the Gestapo came calling. Their usual time, of course, 6 a.m. They searched the house up and down, but didn't find him. Went away, everybody delighted and relieved, claps on the back, or whatever the Belgians do, and the Gestapo came back. She pretended to be Dulally to try and get him off, but her husband was arrested, taken away, and she never saw him again. And that sort of thing would have happened time and time and time again in this country if the Nazis had won. I used to see Turing from time to time, and I have a strong mental image of him walking along the corridor in one of the huts with his gaze turned downwards. He was a shy and diffident man, flicking the walls with his fingers, dressed in a mid-dark brown sports jacket and baggy grey trousers. This is not your Achilles figure. He was not a warrior king, but at that juncture, he was the most influential man in Europe, bar none. In a way, bar Churchill. And we owe this to Turing.
Thank you to the staff, volunteers and visitors of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. Also, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are at BPark Podcast. Thanks also go to the National Museum of Computing for allowing us to record Colossus. And a big thank you must go to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible, especially to Mark, James and Amanda. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening. We'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.